This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Let's get a perspective from European activism. For many years, Nicholas Heringer has been a voice for peace and climate justice. He organizes, publishes articles, connects people, and speaks to media. Nicholas is Associate Director for Movement Partnerships for 350.org. From France, Nicholas Heringer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks a lot. Hello.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just released its final report of three, and they say it is do-or-die time for climate this decade. We must act this decade. Could we call it their final warning?
You know, they've been raising the alarm for many years. The IPCC was created in 1988, and since then, every single report that they've published was raising the alarm. But yes, it's basically now or not never, because there will always be something to fight for, but it is now or never if you really want to, you know, create or maintain the conditions for a livable and peaceful future. So definitely, everyone who's taking very seriously what the IPCC writes and say should stop doing what they do, should stop their business as usual, and really consider what can be done for climate justice and peace.
Well, this year's IPCC reports from the first and second working group were full of warnings based on the best of science. What was this third working group report intended to do, Nicholas?
So the third working group from the IPCC is a working group looking at solutions. It is the one that is aiming at helping us understand what the roadmap or what the pathway towards a world at 1.5 degrees of warming is. And what this report has highlighted is that we can still get there. We can still make it. But in order to make it, we have to halve our emissions by 2030. So indeed, we only have a very short window of time, you know, to keep the promise of the Paris Agreement, which is basically the promise of a livable future, of something that can maintain the conditions for peace, for social justice across the world.
Some activists were a little disappointed in this final effort. It was supposed to show us the best ways to avoid a climate catastrophe, but there's a lot of lawyer-like talk in it. All the code words are there, but it seems to lack a cohesive vision. Nicholas, what are your first impressions of this third working group report, and what is 350.org saying about it?
I don't think that the role of the IPCC is to provide us with a vision. The interest and the strength of the IPCC is that it is about the science. Right? The IPCC is not a research center. The IPCC is the global community of scientists telling us that these are the facts. This is what we know. This is what we should do. But the vision is something that we, the movement and the people, have to provide. The IPCC is, to some extent, you know, providing the foundation to our common house. And everything that comes after, the walls, the roof, the furniture, the rooms, etc., is for the movement and the people to provide. So our role is indeed, you know, to create that vision. And our vision is that, first, change will be people-powered. Change will come from below. Change won't come from world leaders. Change won't come from the fossil fuel companies because, you know, we've listened and waiting for them to act for too many years, and we don't have the time to wait again. So we need to be the ones creating that change. The other thing that we have in our vision is that it is very possible, you know, to we know that climate change is here to stay. That's not something we can argue over. Climate change is a reality, and it will have dire consequences on our lives. And too many lives have already been lost. Yet every degree matters, every tenth of a degree matters, every tree, every species, every community that we can protect and save matters, and there was a fight. And so our vision is that we need, you know, to start this just transition towards a renewable future for all. We need to start it from below, at the community level. We need to make sure that in order to go there, we cut ties with the fossil fuel industry, and we develop that future in which we have ownership over the decision on energy.
After interviewing a couple of hundred climate scientists in the last few years, it seems hard to believe we can hold global warming to 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. Some people feel we're already past that in a way, or we're committed to going past that. Do you think world governments who sign off on this report are telling us the full truth about our climate situation?
You know, after the Paris Agreement, the IPCC was mandated to write a special report on 1.5. That report was published 2 years ago, and it said that it is still possible. Now, the possibility is tiny. It's clear that 1.5 is going to be hard to reach. And I would even add, you know, that up until very recently, we, including activists and people working in the climate movement, we believed that 1.5 was the so-called safety barrier, that a climate at 1.5 would be safe. It's not the case. The only safe level of warming is 0 degrees. We live currently at a world at 1.1 degree of warming compared to pre-industrial levels. And we're already seeing, you know, the many consequences, the mega fires, the drought, the storms. So we are seeing the consequences of global warming, and we are not even at 1.5 yet. But this being said, there is a huge difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees of warming. There is a huge difference between 2 degrees of warming and 3 degrees of warming. So maybe, yes, we won't be able to keep global warming to 1.5, but if we can keep it to 1.6 instead of 3.1, that's a big difference. And the difference is not, you know, in terms of cosmetic, or is not in terms of, you know, the landscape we're looking at. We are talking about millions of lives, billions of lives that would be saved. So the fight is worth, you know, fighting, even if maybe, yes, the horizon of 1.5 is too far away for us.
Let's talk about activism in this new decade. When the pandemic struck, it was risky to bring crowds together for protests. We thought, well, we'll wait a year and then resume climate action. Now we still have the virus, and the war in Ukraine is eating up most media time and public attention. The last two IPCC reports have gone almost unnoticed or not got what they should have. This is the challenge. Nicholas, how can we work for climate action even during multiple other crises?
It's not necessarily a problem, but maybe actually the solution, the way we should look at it. I think in the climate movement, we've said for decades now that this is about system change. And by saying this is about system change, we are saying that this crisis has several dimensions. It's not just about the climate. It's not just about CO2 emissions. It's about social justice. It's about extractivism. It's about the imbalance of power in between nations. And so maybe the complexity that we're facing at the moment is actually the clue. We need to acknowledge that the situation is complex. We need to acknowledge that we need to act at different levels, and that we need to, you know, use our leverage wherever we can. And to that extent, I think that it is very interesting that, you know, the IPCC was awarded the Peace Nobel Prize in 2007. And the IPCC was about to approve its Working Group 2 report at the moment where Russia invaded Ukraine. And I don't think it is a coincidence. I think that, you know, when the IPCC was awarded the Peace Nobel Prize, what the Nobel Committee was basically saying is that the IPCC is not just about science. It's not just about climate change. It is an institution of peace. And our movement is henceforth not just a movement for climate justice. It is a peace movement of our time. And so we basically need to work on our two, you know, feet or two legs. There is one leg which is about halving emissions and then, you know, bending the curve and making sure that we can achieve zero emissions by 2050. But the other leg is to say that this is like getting rid of the fossil fuel industry, getting rid of coal, gas, and oil is not just about CO2 emissions. It is also about peace. It is also about justice. And so I think it is actually something that should encourage us to keep on mobilizing, to keep on working, to keep on, you know, fighting for this just transition, because it won't have only an impact on climate. It will have an impact on the geopolitics. It will have an impact on the possibility or not of peace to be installed.
We hear predictions that global warming and climate disruption in the next decades could force large waves of refugees, millions of people searching for safer places to live. You recently published an article titled, "We Must Turn Solidarity with Ukraine into the New Normal for All Refugees." What are you thinking there?
We had a tendency, at least at the level of states, to see migration as a threat. And states were insisting on the fact that we cannot welcome everyone. It's not possible. And the war on Ukraine has actually proven that it is very possible. Right? Millions, 2 million of refugees at least, have been welcomed in Europe with open arms. And so this has created the example that we can actually be welcoming people who are forced to leave their country for whatever reason. The challenge now is to make sure that this is not just about the war on Ukraine, but that we can expand this solidarity to other refugees. And so my point in this piece was to say one of the best ways, one of the most powerful ways that, you know, social movements create change is by setting precedent, is by making the unprecedented happen. And this is exactly what we're seeing at the moment. But yes, the war on Ukraine is absolutely dramatic. Yes, too many lives have been lost because of the war machine. But at the same time, we are seeing an unprecedented level of solidarity which could pave way to what we fight for more generally than just about Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine has brought new conditions that many thought impossible before, including a new look at the peril of depending on fossil fuels. This time, the activism spread even to the sports world and corporate behavior. What can the climate movement win from these big shifts in society?
The first thing that we're winning is that, as I said, we are showing that it is possible. You know, everything that we were told was not possible. Boycotting Russian fossil fuels, having, you know, the sports universe commit to political action or climate action. We were told that this was not possible. We were told that this was too complex, that, you know, what was at stake was too important. Yet we are seeing that it is actually possible. And that when we were told that this was not possible or that this was too complex, it was only because those in power had too many interests in maintaining the status quo. Now, because of the war on Ukraine, those, like, the wealthiest and the one person and those leading us, the world leaders, have realized that it is in their interest to at least temporarily shift gears and listen to some of the demands that we used to make in the past and that we're not listening to. Now, our task is basically to make sure that we won't get back to normal. We won't get back to the business as usual that was in place prior to the war, but that this set of policies, this set of sanctions, this set of boycott measures will be implemented throughout the year, and not just about Russia, but about the fossil fuel industry in general, and about all the regimes that are arming people's human rights.
As a response to Russian forces in Ukraine and the rocky European dependence on Russian gas, many governments and big oil companies in the West announced major new projects to bring more fossil fuels out of the ground, not less. Canada, which talked so green after COP26, just announced approval of the Bay du Nord oil drilling project in the stormy ocean off Newfoundland and the East Coast. What can we do about this backsliding into the old and deadly energy exploits?
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing here is just like those who have interest in the status quo just fighting back for business as usual to come back to what it was before. Let's look at the situation very seriously. A new fossil fuel project that would be developed now will only start producing oil or gas in 10, 15, or 20 years. So we're actually not talking about a project whose aim would be to, you know, help us get rid of our dependence on fossil fuel, on Russian fossil fuels. We're just talking about companies using this as an opportunity to push for projects that would otherwise not be acceptable. This is just like we need to expose this as just being them seizing the moment as an opportunity to defend their own interest. And so what we need to do is to basically seize the moment as an opportunity to defend the climate justice and peace agenda.
The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, just tweeted this: climate activists are sometimes depicted as dangerous radicals, but the truly dangerous radicals are the countries that are increasing the production of fossil fuels, end quote. So have you been called a dangerous radical? And what finally gives the UN head permission to speak such an awful truth?
Yeah, I've been called dangerous radical. I've been arrested a few times by the police for just, you know, raising the alarm, for just, you know, doing what the IPCC is telling us to do. And so I think that, yes, having the UN Secretary General, you know, completely change the lens and language on us activists is really important because it gives us legitimacy. And I think a lot of what we do, you know, we at Swifty and in the climate movement in general are trying to make the case for what we call climate disobedience or civil disobedience applied to climate. And one of the key elements and ingredients of civil disobedience is to get states to recognize a state of necessity, which is basically the idea that, yes, we are not always respecting the law. We are sometimes, you know, trespassing on ground that we are not allowed to trespass. But we are doing it because the company on which ground we are trespassing is not respecting the Paris Agreement or, you know, international agreements or, you know, national laws on climate. And the point of the state of necessity is to show that this infringement of the law that we are making as activists is actually much smaller and less harmful than the larger and bigger infringement from the company. And having the UN Secretary General say that, say what he said, is basically telling, yes, these people, they're absolutely right, and what they do is actually respecting the spirit of the law. So this is really important. This is, even I would say, game-changing.
In December, Italy announced their super bonus plan to pay the entire cost of retrofitting a home, even a rented one, to be energy efficient, including solar power. Germany has guaranteed high solar prices for a long time, and I believe I heard France requires solar on new homes. But here in North America, we have nothing to encourage people to install green energy. Nicholas, why do you think European governments are so far ahead of North America on renewables?
One of the reasons might be that, as opposed to Canada and the U.S., we heavily rely on fossil fuel imports. And so we have probably, states in Europe have maybe an additional incentive to develop renewable energy, which is related to energy security. This is maybe the one thing that is missing in North America. However, I think this might happen very fast as well in North America for various reasons. The first reason is obviously the prices, right? The energy price crunch is going to affect everyone. And we'll soon realize that renewable energy has this almost magical element, which is that its marginal cost is close to zero. Once you've installed solar panels or wind turbine, then the electricity that it produces costs nothing because it doesn't depend on, you know, any complex technology and human and technological intervention. It's just nature helping us produce energy. That's the first reason. The second reason is that we'll realize also very soon that the more local the energy production is, the safer and the better it is. And so I think it's just a matter of maybe, you know, weeks, months, hopefully, and this is one of the goals of the movement is to speed this up. The pace at which the transition will happen is only a matter of political will. I think this is one of the key lessons of, you know, the last few weeks of development.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are speaking with our guest, Nicholas Heringer from 350.org. And I want to ask, is climate activism still alive? From your post at 350.org, could you tell us about a couple of actions you've heard about in various countries?
The first thing that I think is worth mentioning is that the largest demonstration for peace and solidarity with the Ukrainian people in Europe have been organized in Germany by the climate movement. And so I said earlier, it is not a coincidence. The climate movement is the peace movement of our time. And there were like hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Berlin, Hamburg, and other German cities asking for solidarity with the Ukrainian people, asking for a strict embargo on Russian fossil fuels. So that's the first thing that has really been striking and amazing over the last few weeks. Another thing that I think is worth mentioning is there is a mobilization at the moment in Uganda and Tanzania to fight against the East African crude oil pipeline. This is a pipeline that would start in Uganda, so in the middle of the south of the African continent, and would go all the way east to the shores of Tanzania. And this is the longest crude oil pipeline being developed at the moment. And crude oil has this specificity that it can only remain fluid if it is maintained at a certain temperature. And so this pipeline will actually be heated. So we're basically talking about Total and other companies building a pipeline with, say, a heating system which would aim at maintaining the old fluid. This is a real climate bomb. And there are communities now fighting in Uganda and Tanzania against this project. And these communities are saying, in solidarity with Ukraine, we want Total Energy to leave Russia, but we also want Total to leave Tanzania and Uganda. And we're fighting together with our, you know, Ukrainian friends and allies in the same direction. And I think this is really powerful to see these kinds of solidarity and cross-messaging emerge in such dark times.
In the old days, Greenpeace would get media attention by hanging people off buildings or locking themselves to the rails to stop a dangerous cargo. The media somewhat became bored with climate action and they stopped reporting on some of it. But how are activists bypassing those media empires to reach masses of people directly?
It's a very good question. I think it's worth maybe reminding ourselves that before the pandemic in September 2019, we just had organized the largest protest in contemporary history on climate. More than 7 million people took the streets in September 2019. Greta Thunberg was invited to the UN General Assembly, and so there was a global day of action at the end of September, and it was, the biggest global mobilization on climate, and it was probably actually the second biggest mobilization, global mobilization ever, whatever the issue is about. So we were in a context where masses were joining the climate movement, and there was still momentum. I think I remember that, you know, after this day of action was over, the first thing we all said is, this is just the beginning. The only reason why this has stopped is the pandemic in lockdown. And so I think it is our role now to try and find the sparkle that will bring people back onto the streets massively. And one of the things that has, you know, driven people to the streets is access to energy, right? Back in 2019, if you look at what happened in Chile, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Algeria, or in France with the Yellow Vest movement, there was a global wave of protest. And most of these protests were related somewhat to the issue of access to energy. And now that we're seeing these prices increase, this price crunch on energy, and the consequences of the war on Ukraine on the price of oil, the price of gas, and obviously also the price of food, we might very well, you know, be at the very beginning of a new wave of protest.
Tell us about the International People's Platform for Climate Justice. What is that?
So when the IPCC published its Working Group 3 report, we at 350 launched the IPCJ. So it is the International People's Platform on Climate Justice. And our ambition is to complement the work of the International Panel on Climate Change. The idea with this platform is to have a hub where people can tell stories, three different type of stories. The first type of stories is stories about how climate change impacts us. Because the IPCC is very good at, you know, coming up with figures and science and data, but its role is not to come up with stories. Its role is not to focus on the human angle. And so we want to shed light on how impacted we are by climate change. The second type of stories aims at pivoting from a focus on the impacts of climate change on people to the impact that we, the people, have on climate change. And we want to shed light on our agency, on our capacity to change the course of things. So we want to highlight stories of resistance, ensure that, you know, throughout the world, people are fighting against the fossil fuel industry, against projects, infrastructures that would eventually destroy the climate, destroy the environment. And we want to list our many successes. Because actually, the climate movement has won a lot. We've blocked so many pipelines. We've not blocked so many coal power plants. We've divested trillions from the fossil fuel industry. And sometimes we tend to forget how powerful we are. So we want to show this agency that we have by resisting. But we also, and this is the third types of stories, we also want to show that we have agency by being creative. It's not just by blocking that we have agency, but by being creative. And so we want to show stories of people-powered solutions, how at the community level, and sometimes in the very same regions that are affected by climate change, people are organizing to develop alternatives to the fossil fuel industry, small-scale energy schemes, small-scale energy consumption and production schemes that are paving way to a 100% renewable future. So this is the project with the IPCG, which is also articulated together with an international panel of citizen experts. So we have people like Naomi Klein, we have the Indian writer Amitav Ghosh, we have leaders from the climate movement from all over the world who have agreed to come together on a panel. And the role of the panel will be to, you know, push the platform, identify stories that are worth being telling, and hopefully also every now and then come up with a people's assessment report on climate change.
Well, listeners, you can find all these ideas for real climate action from around the world at ourclimateimpact.org, ourclimateimpact.org. Nicholas, the latest IPCC report says we are in a race to make very big changes to all levels of society in every corner of the world. Our emissions need to peak by 2025, and then greenhouse gas emissions need to be drastically reduced by 2030. So far, we don't see any of that happening. Greenhouse gas emissions in 2021 set another new record. So honestly, personally, do you think humanity can avoid 2 or 3 degrees warming by the end of this century?
Yes, absolutely. The IPCC focuses a lot on tipping points, and tipping points in a very negative way, right? In the vision of the IPCC, the focus is on these moments where we reach a level where, you know, like, for instance, the melting of the ice cap is so big that it will then trigger other forms of change for worse. Now, I think with the IPCC, we want to focus on a different type of tipping points, social tipping points, which are the level after which, you know, in society, once enough people have changed their behavior, when enough people have adopted a different set of values, change is inevitable. And it's been proven by different types of research that this social tipping point is probably around a quarter of the population. When a quarter of the population has a new set of values or, you know, new different behaviors in terms of consumption, then change becomes inevitable. But when you're at 20, 21, 22% of the population, you might not see the change happen. This is the nature of a tipping point, is that it's only visible afterwards, once you've reached the moment where you tip. And our assumption, our belief, is that we're very close to that tipping point. So this is the hope. The hope is that, you know, we might very well have already changed system, yet we're not seeing it because we are just in the midst of the change. But in a few years, we will realize that, yes, we had reached that moment.
So it may not be a long, long battle over years or decades. We might be surprised by a revolution or a tipping point in our lives, do you think?
Yes and no. Yes, completely. I think we might very well witness, you know, how rapidly things can change once a few elements, a few dominoes have started to fall. No, in the sense that I don't think there will be a moment where we can say, okay, this is over, we won. That won't happen. You know, there will always be room for mobilization. There will always be the necessity for people to fight. So there won't be a moment where we can say, this is the end of history, we won, period. You know, this is going to last, especially because, and this is what the IPCC is saying in its Working Group 2 report, climate change is here, and it's here to last. So our lives, our present and our future are impacted by climate change. We won't get back to normal. So there will be, you know, lives impacted by our overconsumption and combustion and extraction of fossil fuels, which is also why, besides everything that we're talking about in terms of, you know, change strategy, we have to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable. We have to make them pay. They have to pay for the damage they've created. They have to pay for the reparation for the damage they've created. This is not another important leg of the work we're talking about and of the fight for climate change.
Nicholas, as we finish our time together, what will you be working on next?
There are now conversations happening around the possible Global Day of Action for Climate Justice and Peace, a Global Day of Action which would officially, you know, in the movement, connect the dots between how we fight against the war on Ukraine and how we fight at the same time to implement the recommendations from the IPCC. So we have a series of meetings within the next few days, and hopefully, you know, through a big alliance and coalition of organizations from civil society across the world, we might align on a Global Day of Action probably early May. And hopefully this would be, you know, maybe the beginning of this global wave of protest that I've mentioned earlier on.
From 350.org in Europe, we've been speaking with Nicholas Heringer. Listeners can get climate action stories and learn from bright minds around the world at ourclimateimpact.org. And of course, you should plug into 350.org on a bunch of different social media platforms. I will put links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Nicholas, thank you so much for sharing time with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.